Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
Today we are the children of the Counter-Revolution. We are going to be talking about growing up after the end of history, realizing the full fruits of the conservative counter-revolution that restructured the United States and molded it into what it is today. So, I think we have got three pretty similar perspectives in Jason, Kevin, and I, and then one drastically different one in Jenny.
What's good?
And, yeah. I'm glad Jenny was able to overcome all of her technical difficulties to be here with us.
Not quite. Just gave you more work to do.
Okay, so, Jason, do you want to start us off?
So, we wanted to do this Children of the Counter-Revolution to try to talk through our experiences, I guess, you know, as individuals, but also as a generation, kind of coming of age at the end of history, the onset of neoliberalism, not the onset, really like the full victory of neoliberalism.
The triumph.
Yeah,
of neoliberalism.
The triumph of neoliberalism, of capitalist realism, of the realignment of American political and cultural norms to what would previously have been the far right, you know, the sort of the defeat of the New Deal consensus, the end of liberalism, and really the way in which those things kind of shape our having come to politics, again, as a generation, but also more specifically as individuals, because I think at least a few of us have the experience of really being raised inside the culture, really at the avant-garde of the conservative counter-revolution, which is inside the Christian right. Mm-hmm. So, like, I wrote down that I was defining the conservative counter-revolution. I was defining it. I think we could define the conservative counter-revolution with a couple of, like, key pillars. And one of them is in the political realm, it's sort of white resentment against civil rights, the anti-détente, Cold Warrior anti-communism that kind of comes back into full force, and the sort of America First politics of people like Barry Goldwater and George Wallace. And so that's where you get the sort of the Southern strategy in the Nixon era, and that kind of coincides with the beginning of the Evangelical Crusade, sort of culture warrior, anti-feminism, war on drugs, anti-Roe v. Wade, homeschool, moral majority focus on the family people. And then, you know, as I was saying before, the neoliberal consensus in the ruling classes of the world, you know, the tax cuts, deregulation, welfare reform, union busting, end of the New Deal, the death of military Keynesianism, and the sort of return to the normal laissez-faire, market-oriented, unfettered capitalism. That's the environment in which, as a generation, we were born and raised in. Whether you were actually like a part of the Christian right as a kid, like I was, or if you just grew up in a world where the Christian right was a phenomenon, it's like it's a markedly distinct period from the generation before. And I think, you know, we like to talk a lot about the baggage and traumas of our lives on the left as activists our adult lives. But,
that shit doesn't even come close to the fucking trauma and baggage that I have in my life as a result of being raised.
This is a more generalizable. So I just thought it'd be fun to talk it out.
And I'm here for you because couldn't be me.
Because Jenny, you were raised Catholic, right?
Yes, and I have my own like Catholic guilt to work through, but that manifests in incredibly different ways than like Protestantism. So, it's just a different set of problems and issues to work through. Because I mean, Catholics are notoriously hypocritical in ways that work to benefit us. Like everybody gay. Everybody's having abortions. You just go to fucking mass and then you go to confession. Yeah, you don't have to think about it anymore. so I mean, it just looks, my experience growing up in a fairly religious household. Like, I went to CCD, I went to Mass every Sunday until I was a teenager and got to make my own decisions. I was in youth group, and I don't think any of those things, like, irreparably, like, yeah, same damaged here.
Wait,
me.
You got to make your own decisions?
Yeah, man. Damn. That shit was tight.
Yeah, I didn't get to make my own decisions till I moved out of my parents' house.
Well, so I think the thing, too, is that, like, I didn't grow up in a conservative household either, you know, because Catholics also tend to be Democrats. And also, my family is brown. like, my grandparents did, like, voter registration drives with the Democratic Party. And, I mean, my own shit to work through when it comes to, like, feeling the pressure to, like, identify as a Democrat or whatever, but none of that, I don't think, really is tied to, like, my Catholicism growing up. That's important to note, too, is that, like, while I did grow up Catholic, I did not, by any stretch of the word, really grow up conservative at all.
So, Kevin, what denomination were you raised in?
That's a really good question. My dad, when he was young, was raised Catholic, but did not follow through with that into his young adulthood. He was raised Catholic by Boston Irish parents. My mom was raised Southern Baptist. They got together and then became devoted religious fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, of a new breed, a new stripe of their own making. When I was very young, I remember going to a somewhat obscure denomination called Church of Christ, which is an extremely conservative denomination that forbids singing or, I'm sorry, forbids music or dancing or anything other than a cappella music because of some very bizarre reading of, like, one random verse in Psalms or something like that, or ostensibly because of that reading. So it's it's a very small denomination, doesn't have a whole lot of followers, but you can imagine it's just like a bunch of very, very, very tightly wound conservative people. Then when I got a little bit older, my parents kind of went off the deep end and went into that, like, non-denominational denomination that is the
like a mega church?
Yeah, well, it's the offshoot of the Pentecostal sort of wing of Christianity, where there's a variety of churches where I had the experience of moving from town to town when I was younger, my parents somehow constantly found the local non-denominational church that was in the same, you know, the same variety of, you know, sort of falling out in the spirit and speaking in tongues and, you know, raising your hands while you sing worship and that kind of stuff. So I had kind of two sort of, like, extremes throughout my upbringing, but both were tied together with extreme cultural conservatism and religious fundamentalism.
So our church was a breakaway from the Assemblies of God, which is a breakaway from the Church of Christ. I think it's a breakaway of the Church of Christ. Anyway, Assemblies of God was at one point affiliated with the same milieu from which the Church of Christ comes. But the way we were raised, we didn't really believe in the hard double predestinarianism of like most Calvinist-influenced Protestant churches. So we definitely had the whole faith must be proven by works thing going on, you know? So, like, we were taught that, in the same way that the Catholics are taught, that the things that you do in life matter as to whether or not you get into heaven, because if you're not doing good things and you're sinning, that means you're not truly a Christian. But one of the things we also didn't have was confession and absolution. So, you know, we had all the Catholic guilt without any of the absolution.
Right.
Yeah. I was never sure whether or not I was going to go to hell or not when I was a kid, because I always thought, God, I guess I'm not a real good Christian and I'm probably going to go to hell because I keep doing things that are bad.
Yeah, I would say that, like, you know, Catholics, you know, they carry that sort of weight of what, you know, what we call Catholic guilt. And that seems like a hell of a cross to bear, right? But I had this conversation with a friend recently that it just doesn't compare to the Protestant anxiety, you know, the sort of the constant state of alertness and vigilance that you're sort of ideologically trained and required to maintain, because you're in a constant state of spiritual warfare, you know, because absolution is not a thing that you can, you know, like Chris, like you just said, you don't just get to go and start with a clean slate after confession. It's like literally seconds after whatever thing that you are doing, which is righteous, you could be pulled immediately back into something that's wicked.
Right. And everything is a potential source of spiritual influence. Like I remember watching Star Wars was something that would introduce demons into your life, you know, like they just, like, literally they would think that they would, by putting on the Star Wars VHS, demons would be able to influence you, or playing with a Star Wars toy or something, or like reading a comic book. So there's just constant bombardment from all sides of negative spiritual influences that can tempt you to do wrong, which would prove that you don't actually believe the things that you read in the Bible, and you don't actually believe the confession that you have made, and which means, by that logic, grace isn't extended to you, and you're not actually going to go to heaven because you're not actually.
It's kind of like it's like the Cultural Revolution.
Pretty fucking terrible.
Okay, no, it's,
yeah, exactly.
It's like being on the American left.
It's like being woke.
Yeah,
you're never really woke enough. So, you know, just constant self-flogging and flagellation and confessions in public. Like if someone in the congregation, like, cheated on their spouse or something, they would, like, get up and admit it in front of the congregation and have everyone pray for them.
Wow.
You know? It's like shit like that.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
God.
The performative yeah. Wokeness of evangelical Protestantism is the only real difference between that and, like, let's say the worst sections of the left right now is institutionalization, maybe.
Yeah.
But in terms of the psychological effects of that environment, I think that they're pretty similar, which mm-hmm. is the whole reason I wanted to talk about this, actually.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me like it couldn't help but have, like, a really strong influence on the way in which at least millions of us in the United States today relate to the world, even as, you know, people who aren't conservatives, aren't Christians anymore, right? That our upbringing has, like, left an imprint on our psyches, and I think we see it playing out a lot. And I don't think it's necessarily the case that every single one of us grew up in some kind of hop in the bus and drive to Pensacola for the revival kind of youth group or whatever, but that cultural phenomenon exists and influences the whole country.
Shit, y'all did that too.
Yep,
we sure did.
I gotta say, it was one of the dumbest trips I've ever taken, and I got in trouble for listening to non-Christian music on the...
Wow, I only ever got to go to Mexico, and that was cool.
Well, I did that too, but not with church.
So, I don't know what this says about me, though, but help me unpack this. So you do your first confession when you're 7, or I did when I was 7, I believe. And I couldn't think of anything, because when you're 7, like, and you're me, I was a great kid. So I literally lied at my first confession, because I was like, I don't know what sins I've done. Here's some shit. Because I'm stuck in this room with a priest behind a screen until I say something. So...
That's the most Catholic shit
That's what I'm saying. Sorry, sweeties. I'm just...
I remember you're supposed to tithe 10% of all of your earnings to the church. And I pretended that I thought 10% of $10 was 10 cents. And tithe that. But the way that our church did it was you would put your cash or whatever in an envelope and write your name and everything on it.
Oh, God.
And then at the end of the year, they would give you back, like, a receipt for your taxes so that you could, I guess, like, claim it as a charitable donation. And I got one back for 10 cents, and I got busted because my mom saw it.
Oh, my God.
She's like, is that from that $10?
Like, oh. You're like, oh, yeah, sorry, I'm really bad at math. And then you committed to that ruse for the rest of your life.
I did. Until I got to university and got, like, good grades in math, and everyone was like, wait, I thought you sucked at math. I was like,
only in church.
I'm only no, bad you know, at church.
But that math. Actually kind of illustrates that the only money that I got that year was that $10.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we were poor.
Wait, so before going too much deeper into just growing up, you know, the sort of growing up inside the reactionary churches that we grew up in, I wanted that comment about tithing, whatever. It made me think about the sort of the political connections to the existence of the sort of multiplicitous reactionary churches, because like the whole movement, the whole evangelical crusade, kind of new Christian right, it like we weren't around for it, right? I wasn't alive. None of us were alive during the desegregation fights. We weren't alive during, you know, George Wallace or Barry Goldwater's or even Richard Nixon's presidential campaigns, but what we are talking about in the late 80s and early 90s, in the sort of tail end of the Reagan years, and when all of this stuff has become institutionalized, I guess what we're really talking about is having grown up in the environment in which the counter-revolution is victorious. What's really interesting to me is the way in this sort of, as I've been reading about it, as it becomes a kind of a burgeoning movement, the stuff about tax exemption and the stuff about homeschooling, and you know that all kind of boils. It all has its origins in the way in which, you know, middle class white people wanted to pull their kids out of integrated schools, and they wanted to be able to like use money to lobby the federal government to fight desegregation. And then, you know, it's just really interesting to me that the way in which like race is so thoroughly baked into every single thing that influences our lives and every single thing that we do, to the point where we don't even know it. You know, like it's, there wouldn't be these weird churches that we grew up in nearly on the scale to where they were so normal. Like there wouldn't be no Joel Osteens and mega churches every 3 or 4 miles when you drive through Fort Worth or whatever, if first you didn't have this like massive backlash to civil rights.
You know, say what you will about religious persecution in China, but one of the coolest things that I have ever seen is the Chinese government detonating those mega churches.
Hell yeah.
And I really think that that's something we should do here.
That's hell such yeah. a good way to start a sentence.
Yeah.
I mean, not all churches, and I don't think we should persecute the people in them. I just think should detonate those churches.
Oh,
and
I
make them.
And maybe persecute the, you know, the Joel Osteens of the world. I would be all right with that.
I mean,
it depends on what we mean by
it. It's kind of a waste of space. We can repurpose them.
I mean, I don't think we should repurpose them. Those gigantic fucking aluminum pieces.
They're just chunks of concrete. You're right. Yeah. You're right.
Unless I guess we could store food in them or something.
Turn them into a movie theater or whatever.
We could turn them into all turn them into movie theaters.
All of them.
Actually, you know what? One of the things that I want to, that I really hope happens after the revolution is just this flourishing of the human spirit that we always say will happen when the constraints of, you know, capitalism are removed. And we'll want to destroy these ugly fucking formless squares of concrete and build beautiful things.
You know? It would be a lot like definitely the Confederate monuments, you know, like the ones that were built specifically to intimidate, you know, newly registered black voters. The people are like, oh, that's our, like, you know, these, like, heritage and history or whatever, because they think they're from the Civil War. That's the way I feel about mega churches and the Protestant denominations in the United States, too. It's like,
that's one of the things I will actually agree with right-wingers on, is that is their heritage.
Well, okay, that's true.
It's just, it's what their heritage is shitty, fucking mass-produced garbage that is racist.
Yeah. Well, it is their heritage, and it does deserve to be destroyed.
Yeah, fuck their heritage.
So that...
And that's the tea.
So that...
No, it is not.
That leads me...
It is!
That leads me to the sort of second half of the sort of prehistory point I was trying to make, which is the way in which this relates to American Catholics. Because one of the other things that I've learned recently is the way in which, you know, it's the sort of the unity of the Catholic Church with the various rabid right-wing evangelical churches over the opposition to Roe v. Wade. Or actually, rather, the response to Roe v. Wade, where you really see this sort of like they find this popular front that really cements the power of this crusading evangelical ultra right, where you would have like Catholics who were pro union and, you know, pro civil rights or whatever, and there's a whole social justice strand in American Catholicism going back to before the Depression. And, you know, you wouldn't have them getting up with a Jerry Falwell or a Billy Graham to decry the morality of the hippies or whatever. But you would have them put their money into campaigns to fight Roe v. Wade. And you would have them put their votes into candidates who promised to fight Roe v. Wade. And those candidates all tend to be the ones that have this stronger reactionary agenda.
Which is that the Catholic Church has, like, largely participated in part of these, like, blowbacks, too. But also, the majority of Catholics are pro-choice.
Right, yeah. It's like
better or worse.
It's, like, over the heads of the Catholic, the lay people. And even, maybe even against the best intentions of, you know, the clergy, whatever, is that, you know, American Catholics have been these sort of junior partners in American evangelicals. Counter-revolution, which is explicitly anti-union, anti-communist. You know, they have all these preachers that this prosperity gospel, this sort of Jesus would have been for free markets, and that somebody like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush could represent Christianity. And most Catholics wouldn't actually think that, but they're still, by virtue of these sort of institutional relationships built over the abortion stuff, they prop up the Christian right.
I think that is perfectly illustrated in our family, because though we were raised in the Assemblies of God, or an offshoot of the Assemblies of God or whatever, our entire family on both sides is Catholic. And our parents were raised Catholic. And we actually spent a whole hell of a lot of time in Catholic churches growing up with my grandparents, who would watch us over the weekends in a lot of instances. But my grandmother is extremely devout, more so than any of her children, who are all Catholic, but extremely conservative. And she is very, very much anti-choice, but very much pro-asylum for refugees and against the death penalty, and isn't scared of the idea of Medicare for all, and doesn't think that we should be involved in any wars, you know? She doesn't have a lot of political positions, but the ones that she does have are, you know, the same as Pope Francis's, you know?
Yeah.
But all of her kids are incredibly, incredibly right-wing and don't like the new Pope.
Well, sure. Yeah, and I think, like, it, you know, again, I can only speak on my own experience growing up Catholic, but I think the thing, too, is that, like, people hold these beliefs, and many of the people in my family hold them very close to their hearts, but ultimately are kind of just like, mind your own business about it. Like, you know, there's nothing I can do to control what decisions someone else is making and what their lifestyles are. but I do still think we should care for everyone. I mean, my introduction to any sort of leftism was through the church, you know, in terms of understanding like how to treat people. But also my first venture into any sort of activism was anti-death penalty work through the Catholic Church. I never went on any of the like get a charter bus and go to like a anti-choice whatever and hold up the signs that the church paid for things, but I did do anti-death penalty stuff, you know. It's a mixed bag, but
super mixed bag, and I think that yeah. that's the nature of the whole gig. That's really the thrust of it, is that religion as an ideology, as a thing that exists in society, is dialectical. It's really difficult and complicated, but it's never something that can ever be just like pinned down to like it is the good guy or it is the bad guy. I think that what you know, Jason, Chris, and I experienced was the life of growing up under a social movement with a petty bourgeois ascendant counter-revolutionary vanguard at its head.
Yeah, we grew up in the Handmaid's Tale church, basically.
Right. Yes. But what I want to try to like get at with that is that Chris, you've also identified historical research that you wrote a paper on identifying the clergy in peasant revolts as the sort of revolutionary vanguard party of sorts for the peasants in their rebellion against the aristocracy of the time. The
feudal, right? Aristocracy. Yeah, yeah.
So I think the church leadership can and has historically played an ambiguous role, a leading role, a leadership role. It can and it does, but it very explicitly hangs in the balance of what are the self-perceived interests of the constituents of that sort of vanguard party, if I can be allowed to sort of adopt that language for them. So I think there was you look at the American context specifically, and you can look at the Catholic Church along the southern border. You look at the Black Church in the former Confederacy, and these are institutions that are made up of constituencies who have a very clear antagonism against the existing order. But you look at the white church in the South, or anywhere else in the rest of the United States, and the leadership of these institutions have a very, very, very manifest material interest in advocating for the interests of their wealthiest donors, their wealthiest donor bases, in maintaining the established order. And you look at the Catholic Church globally, and frankly, it's playing the same role, that same reactionary, counter-revolutionary role in much of the world, historically and contemporaneously. It's uniquely a function of its constituency in certain parts of the United States that makes it distinct in that instance.
Yeah, so I have a real question that I don't know the answer to, and maybe you guys can help me. So obviously the Catholic Church in and of itself is a shit bastard, but in terms of actual Catholics, right? So I know there's like this history of like Catholic worker resistance, and obviously, like as Kevin brought up, you know, there's a history of the Black Church involved in civil rights movement and other sorts of work. Is there any history of Protestantism sort of driving any sort of like social or economic justice, or am I like completely just like discrediting like all Protestants?
I mean, Martin Luther, isn't that what he was doing? Was like,
you know, I mean, in like the last century, a
sort of like a democratic revolt against the existing authorities.
We don't have to go back as far as Martin Luther. We can go to Martin Luther King, Jr.
Yeah, there's that. But she said
no. I said the white Protestant church.
Well, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference wasn't just black people, okay. You know. But that okay. that would be it.
Yeah. I mean, I was asking.
Yeah.
No, that's not it. I mean, there are always the Quakers.
Okay. Who yeah. have
been staunchly anti-war.
Make them good oats.
Yes, they do that as well. And I mean, in not necessarily in the United States, but there is a whole strand of Reformed theology in Europe that is pro-communist, and there is Protestant liberation theology as well.
Okay,
it's
but
just not as prolific as the reactionary white Protestantism.
So, why do you think that, like, American Protestantism has like manifested in such ugly ways in comparison to this like Protestant liberation theology that apparently exists in other parts of the world?
Well, that's part of why I thought it was a good idea to start the conversation with some of the kind of the political and economic sort of framework in which the Christian right really takes off. Because I think, you know, it's difficult for us to even imagine, I guess, a time whenever the evangelical vote was a significant thing. But there used to be a time before that, right? So, like, I actually think, I think it really matters that, you know, the right-wing church leaders that developed cozy institutional relationships with right-wing political leaders and gave money to each other and spoke at each other's conferences and built up a mass movement around the, you know, equating, you know, family values and patriotism and Jesus Christ and, you know, like an aggressive foreign policy abroad and like sort of overturn the gains of the 60s and 70s as the domestic agenda. Like, I think they just kind of choked out the space where a Christian left without those institutional relationships just couldn't, you know, it doesn't have the same agenda. It doesn't have the same.
I think it's more than that. I think it's more than that. I think exactly as you point that there's the historical moment is an incredibly sharp one. When there is a long period where the evangelical vote doesn't exist, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, it becomes a force in American politics and American public life that is extremely influential, you know, verging on determinative. I don't think you can look at that and say that is just a, you know, sort of accident of history. I think that it coincides with the ascendant employer's offensive precisely because what it is, what religious fundamentalism broadly is the expression of cultural chauvinism. And
yeah.
The ruling class is engaging in any sort of popular appeal to negate the resistance that is inherently, inevitably going to get out of engaging in all-out class warfare. The only option it has is to appeal to cultural chauvinism. And so that is what the ascendant Christian right is. It is the cultural chauvinism that is that placates the masses so that the employers can fuck us.
Look, there's I mean, Kevin, I think that's right. I mean, there's a historical precedent from, you know, a couple generations before when a crusading evangelical politics existed and exerted influence in the United States, and it's in the 1920s when there were 2 million members of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, and it was
right,
and it was the same thing. It was like opposition to trade unions and foreigners and Catholicism. They made peace with the Catholics, but you know, the obviously this was also during the like a wave a reign of white terror in the South. You know, this is like the peak lynching period. But what the modern day neo fascists in American Christianity figured out is that by being tied to the Republican Party rather than the Ku Klux Klan, they could actually be truly mass and not have, like, you know, a few million people is one thing, but having a 60 million or so people, in the sense that, you know, they figured they can get broader support for a watered down conservative agenda. But there's still that kind of avant-garde that if it was the 1920s, they would be Klan adjacent. And like, I don't say this with like with any intentional hyperbole, but like, I kind of think that's the community that we grew up in, is the people that in the 90s, the people that we grew up in, if it was the 20s, it would have been the Klan adjacent people.
Yeah, and the way that illustration sort of has parallels in other governments would be like the Josef Tiso government in Slovakia, where the ascendant radical right wing of the Catholic Church, not the Protestants, comes to power in as a sort of like, you know, bring back the traditional morals and values kind of movement, and then just collaborates with the Nazis, enacts the ruling classes anti-worker, anti-communist positions in order to stabilize things for you know, capitalism.
Yeah, and you're right. It requires that kind of generalized anxiety.
Yeah, the generalized anxiety against the encroaching other in the form of communism in Hungary, Slovakia, Italy, Spain, whatnot. And these are all places that had a significant sort of clerico-fascist movement that tied itself to the state and carried out the will of capital in order to stabilize things, but used rhetoric of traditional values and morals and Christianity.
Yeah. Like, I don't think that we would have the new Christian right in this country without not just civil rights, the anti-Vietnam War stuff, and, you know,
cultural Marxism,
feminism, and
the threat,
the you know, the fight to stop the Equal Rights Amendment, which they won, but also, you know, mm-hmm. stagflation, a decline in American military power in the wake of Vietnam, you know, and
the slow canceling of the future that was unfolding as a result of neoliberalism.
Right, it's all of these things together, plus the let's say the political savvy of these fucking hucksters who wedded their churches to the furthest right elements of the Republican Party. First of all, they all made millions off of it, but also they had an audience because of that generalized anxiety in American society. You know, there's
it mirrors darkly the anxiety of interwar Europe, you know?
Yeah, that's why the, you know, that sort of liberal gotcha politics around Donald Trump has been divorced and has had affairs, and so he's not even, you know, a good representative of Christianity. Like, well, yeah, Reagan was the first American president to have a divorce, as far as I know. They didn't care because they're still not, and they weren't then looking for a prophet figure. They're looking for a political hammer that they can use to smash anybody standing in their way.
They're looking for their Cyrus the Great.
Yeah,
wait, who's that?
Total.
You're gonna have to explain that one.
I've heard that used to talk about Donald Trump, where he's like a total non-believer and, you know, heathen, but he's doing God's will, just like Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon and let the Jews return to Judea and Israel.
Oh, yeah, right, none of my friends have said that.
It's total casuistry. It's like, it's mental gymnastics to excuse the behavior of the totally anti-Christian president.
Is the entirety of this edifice that is the Christian right. It is all casuistry. It's all self-rationalization. I mean, this is why I stopped being a Christian. Is I was like constantly being dragged from, you know, church to church, from around these different bodies of people who claimed to profess a set of beliefs that were always based around absolute, unwavering faith in this book, this thing that they called the Bible. And yet the things that they obsessed about was never anything that was actually articulated in this foundational text that they claimed to be the basis of their faith. It was always about revolving around some whatever the present issue of social reaction was in society broadly, and they would do so in direct defiance of the text itself. That's the thing that made me start what the hell is this? Why? I don't want to be associated with you people if you don't even follow through in this thing that you claim that you believe, which got me, questioning things more deeply. Sorry, go ahead, Jenny.
Yeah. But I mean, isn't that the thing about morality or religion in general to these folks, is that it's only valuable to them insofar as it is benefiting them and serving their interests. Otherwise, it's just a matter of walking through the motions and performing in the right way, which, I mean, still is in a lot of circles. You know, like that's the thing. Like there's not going to be a gotcha moment with these folks about facts. Like they don't respond to that. They're not going to respond to this weird flexible moral shit either. It's a waste of our time.
No, exactly.
It's almost as if the ruling ideas of society are the ideas of the ruling class.
Yeah.
Oh damn.
You know.
But I there are members of my extended family who are poor Southern whites who I can sit down with and relate to on a very real, personal, mundane level, who you just talk to them and you can tell that they have an instinctive sort of response to fuck the rich. Mm-hmm. It's the world's not fair, it shouldn't be like this, but they show up and they vote Republican because gay marriage and abortion and, my pastor and all of my social networks, my entire community is based on this cultural identity as a member of this, religious grouping, which says that I have to adhere to these different, it's not so much I have to, but which says that this is what is right and good. I don't think that that comes from somewhere, and it doesn't come from the bottom up, right? This reality is imposed by the people at the top of the Christian right, the Jerry Falwells and the mega churches and the people who know what the fuck they're doing. They are very aware of what the fuck they're doing. They are imposing this on the broad layers of society for the purposes of ensuring that their bank accounts don't get touched.
Yeah. Well, and I know this is stuff that y'all know, but it's not a coincidence that the response of the liberals to the Jerry Falwells and Ronald Reagans and moral majorities was to respond to their misogyny, respond to their homophobia at pick your point in history when they decided to start responding to that, respond to their racism, and not have to actually grapple with economic policy or their impact in those ways, which did make working people's lives shittier. So, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, I mean, obviously I'm preaching to the choir here, but it makes sense that the response of white Southerners would be to reject everything that liberals are espousing, including, you know, in opposition to bigotry.
Sure.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's, I think that's right. I think that without this kind of like hollowed out sort of notion of what role a person plays in society, like it, when we move from this kind of like collective sense of like civic engagement or whatever to the kind of individual entrepreneurial ethic of whatever you want to call it, neoliberalism, late capitalism, whatever, this kind of unwitting acceptance of the dominant ideology in society is, it's really easy. It's really easily imposed. And so, you know, whether somebody's religious or not, you know, or liberal or conservative or not, there's kind of like a, the dominant ideology is, it influences everything. And so if you're a part of a community, especially whenever your alternative is only to be an individual entrepreneurial and a failed entrepreneur at that, the passive sort of silent acceptance of the dominant ideology is just all the easier. So Kevin, like when you say like, they, you know, maybe you can relate to each other like on a class level really easily, and I think that I've found that same thing. But then, you know, this sort of political expression manifests in these very different ways. Well, that's because nobody is talking to them on a class level. I mean, maybe you are, right? But not, there is no class crusade for them to join. So there's no alternative collective
right.
identity to have.
Right.
It's either
right.
the liberal, secular, humanist, individual identity, or it's the community
yeah.
that
yeah.
you go be a part of every Sunday for a few hours, and on Wednesday nights, and
yeah.
Thursday night Bible study, and, you know, weekend trips, and mm-hmm. every holiday, and, you know, it's on television all the time, and it gives you some sense of belonging to something. Or you
yeah.
can go fuck off and go be alone and listen to, you know.
Exactly.
This is a dated reference. I don't know who Richard Dawkins types exist now, but, you know, like.
Oh, God.
What a terrible, hollow, meaningless existence.
I'd rather remove my yeah. toenails.
But that's the reason why it took. That's why it took neoliberalism. It took Reagan. It took the
exactly.
defeat of labor.
Yeah.
It took the end of history. It took the collapse of alternatives, you know. However flawed
exactly.
in the USSR and whatever else, because otherwise I just don't think it. I think it doesn't have the same hold on people.
Yeah,
you know, like
we
can talk about our individual disillusionment with growing up in the church, but didn't it also feel bad?
Yeah, it was awful. It sucked.
Didn't
it
suck?
It feels a lot
years?
Like showing up to it feels a lot like showing up to left spaces and getting screamed at constantly for being, you know, morally impure or whatever.
Yeah. You gotta have a strong commitment to those things, to weather that terrible experience of like getting cut loose from your community and then wandering into a hostile sea of, you know, atomized individuals who are, if anything, almost prove the point every time you go outside. It proves the whole be in the world but not of the world thesis of evangelical Christianity.
Okay, so like, you know, Kevin, you mentioned being disillusioned with the church because you saw a complete disconnect between their purported beliefs and what it is that they actually cared about.
Right.
And for me, I just, as I got older, I couldn't believe that the things that these people were telling me were literally true. and it kind of just made me complacent about my religion. I didn't so much care anymore. I still had vague ideas about God existing and whatnot, but I thought, no, there's no way this stuff is true, and whenever I get out on my own, you know, I'll make my own decisions about, you know, what I believe. But what really sort of, like, drove the stake through the heart of my orthodoxy was actually the issue of our particular church's relationship to homosexuality, or, you know, the queer community in general. Because I had been listening to a lot of propaganda and reading leftist literature and stuff like that. And, you know, I was like, hey, wait a minute. Gay people are just, you know, other humans. If the Bible tells me to hate them, which it doesn't, but, you know, that's a conversation for a different day. If my church tells me to hate them, then I kind of feel like, you know, maybe I don't really have anything in common with this church anymore. And through my break with religion, I actually started looking for something else to fill the void that I felt by becoming a non-believer. And I had started paying attention to political things as a result of just listening to punk rock and stuff like that. And then I picked up, I guess it was the collected works of Lenin or something like that. And then like the Tariq Ali book about Trotsky, and just kind of devoured those voraciously and decided I wanted to be a communist.
So I think, yeah, I mean, my trajectory is similar because we're related and we're in the same, you know, house a lot of the time.
And I made you read the books that I read.
Yeah, but I think that, the previous conversation about the overall environment in which, you know, evangelical Christianity becomes the sort of the source of, or let's say the ideological shock troops or whatever, the at the vanguard of the counter-revolution politically, is, it's similar in reverse, because I think it's probably significant that the wave of the new wave of, like, you know, explicitly left-wing political, like punk music or whatever, was, you know, it was coming to us at a time when, you know, there's a, let's say it's Zapatismo, it's global justice, it's Ralph Nader, it's Battle in Seattle, there's a new environment in which that sort of receptiveness that we had as individuals to, you know, critical ideas about the bad experiences that we were having, this, some way of explaining and understanding the terrible world that we were living in. You know, I think it might not have resonated in quite the same way in a different period, like, let's say, like in 2002 or something, right? Whenever things kind of shift the other way. Like, it's, you know, it's the 2008 crash and, you know, the Obama presidency and then Occupy and then all this other stuff that really kicks open the door for people to be receptive to, for something like a Sanders run to be possible, for there to be this new generation of right. socialists.
Well, that's when there's like a mass base for it, right? I think exactly what you're identifying, Jason, is you're identifying pieces of counterculture. I mean, that was a big part of it for me. It was this thing that I was able to reject the dominant culture and sort of find solace in this thing that said, yes, you're right to reject that. And here's why, you know. But I mean, I think it's significant that is where the left ideology existed primarily as a countercultural movement, because it had no mass base for a long time. And it wasn't until the explosion of Occupy in the wake of and Black Lives Matter in the wake of the global the Great Recession that there came burst onto the scene a mass base for these kinds of left politics.
Right. Well, that's why it still feels countercultural most of the time. Just
right,
because that still bears all of the marks of its birth, of its prehistory.
Right. We're all elder millennials, but the generation directly before us that was involved with politics had their politics defined 100% by the new left. And those of them who were communist had it informed by the new communist movement, which was all but dead by the time I came, by the time I started getting into politics. The politics that I came into was one of 100% based on lifestyle and identity, and that was it. You know, all of the punk bands were anti this, anti that, anti, you know, their politics were all purely based on what it is they didn't consume.
Well, that's that sort of unwitting silent acceptance of the dominant ideology, you know? Like, maybe it's
right, which
filtered
is
through some kind of desire to reject it. But if one of the hallmarks of the neoliberal era and the neoliberal order is the stripping down of the individual to just the individual, right? You know, rather than seeing collective self-interest, we only see individual self-interest. Even, you know, it appears to have been so effective that, well, whatever, it was so effective that for a very long time, the only way we even knew how to reject it was to say, as an individual, I reject it.
Yeah, it's definitely, and I'm only low-key serious about this, the legacy of the worst generation in the history of Earth on the political. And no, it's not the boomers, it's Gen X.
It is. Yeah.
It is.
Gen X is the worst generation.
See my recent tweets about Gen X. Yeah, I mean, so I think, like, my first, outside of, like, anti-death penalty work, my first exposure to, like, what political protest and resistance looked like was A, punk rock, and B, seeing like the 1999 protests against World Trade battle in Seattle on MTV News
as
a preteen. And of course that coverage was focusing on like individuals, and in the midst of like this mass protest, MTV is reporting on like Starbucks windows and stuff like that. I was going to go somewhere with that, but maybe someone else can take it and run, because who knows where I was going with it.
Well, I mean,
breaking a Starbucks window is the measure of whether or not you're a revolutionary.
That's what Against Me taught me.
Yes, that's, if I learned anything from listening to crappy folk punk, it's that if you don't break Starbucks windows, oh, you're not a revolutionary.
I love Against Me. Do not at me.
Well, Jenny, does this dovetail with any disillusioning sort of process that you have with church, or did the way you grew up really just not ever wedge you so tightly the way that it did for us to the faith?
Do you mean like the battle in Seattle, or
well, I just mean
larger conversation about things?
I just mean, I guess, so my drift away from my sort of religious upbringing is not entirely parallel step by step, but roughly runs concurrent with my adoption of a kind of a new way of understanding the world.
Sure. So, I mean, that's a loaded question for me, actually, because so I think in a lot of ways, like I stopped caring, but also I started caring a lot more about other things. So it's like I replaced my, which is why I think like it was so easy to like convert me into like Leninism, right? I was such a willing convert because I needed meaning, because I had already decided that religion wasn't doing that for me. So it was like I replaced one form of religiosity. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Religiosity.
Okay, well, it's like I replaced one form of religiosity with another, right? I found this new sense of meaning, this new sense of hope and faith in, like, working class and in the struggle, I didn't really become like overwhelmingly disillusioned, other than that, like, I had decided that I wanted to start sleeping with people or whatever. outside of that, like, I didn't have like a lot of baggage to leave behind. I feel fortunate, because I definitely do know other Catholics who struggle a lot with their upbringing in the church. So I, again, like, I cannot stress enough how much this is just like my personal experience. But yeah, I mean, I think that those things absolutely coincide, but not in, not with like negative, like a ton of negative connotation, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yes. It does. And as always, it always, it all comes down to wanting to fuck people.
Oh, man.
We all came to Marxism from an incredibly religious background. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I say that we all found religious fulfillment in being involved with the socialist movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that kept us bearing the torch through the post 9/11 years, when we were spit on the streets for trying to sell Trotskyist newspapers and, you know,
the Bush era.
Yeah, the Bush era, which was a real tough time to be a Marxist. It was a tough time to be anything except a complete fucking bootlicker. But yeah. Definitely, like, an out and vocal Marxist.
It did take a lot of guts, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It's kind of, in retrospect, it's kind of stupidly, purposely demoralizing to set up a table in part of downtown in the business sector during the Bush years and try to sell communist literature to passersby.
Well, sure. Kids seems counterproductive. Leftist kids these days will never know that struggle. Because while, of course, it is a very tumultuous and terrible time to be a leftist and to be actively organizing, there is it's more polarized. So there's a hell of a shit ton more support now for leftist ideas and for socialist politics. The Bush era was just, you know, there's nothing brings people together like terrorism and war. So it was just a shitstorm from every direction heading to our little paper sale each week.
That must have been what it felt like to be an evangelical in like the late 60s. Just like, oh man, I'm not going to go out there and, like, you know, with two other people and pass out pamphlets about how, you know, the hippies are turning America away from God.
Yeah.
Like, only, like, only the most, the fiercest diehard, like, semi-lunatic, you know, standard
bearers. Yeah, we're passing out chick tracks.
Yeah.
So wait, was selling SW, like, handing out chick tracks?
It's basically the same thing. So if we're moving this metaphor forward, we're in the expansionist phase of the new left, where it's like the Billy Graham era.
Well, yeah, there is a new socialist movement, and we are in the Billy Graham era of the new socialist movement. Which means,
is that supposed to be a positive statement?
How do we get to the Tammy Faye Baker area once she decided that gay people were cool?
Well, you know what? That actually is kind of a position that is that has been articulated as a political lesson to learn from the, like, Pat Robertson approach to the Republican Party, is that there are people in the American socialist left that say what the left can learn from the new right is that the same way that the right kind of like wedded itself to certain figures in conservative politics and kind of brought their congregations into you know, into the fold as a voting bloc, and like, you know, sort of cross-pollinated sort of big tent revival setting with sort of political campaign setting, you know, that there's something that the left can learn from that too. I don't think that that's the case, but it's not like a, it's not an unpopular position.
Well, I think it's right insofar as it goes as a lesson in how to understand your place in the political game and how to play that to the best advantage that you can. I think there's a point where it kind of breaks down, where it tries to sort of transpose church congregations to the working class, and I don't think that those are two distinct populations necessarily. There's a lot of overlap, and church congregations aren't a class constituency entirely.
That's right.
That gives rise to some differences that, you know, can't just kind of be like hand waved away.
Well, this is why I, you know, let's say I have a somewhat less optimistic tone about everything than a lot of people on the new left, you know, because. I don't think that left-wing and right-wing strategies can roughly approximate each other for a number of reasons. And one of them is that the strategies of the Christian right, they only require the mobilization of a constituency at the most, at the level of, you know, barely participating, right? Mm-hmm. It's really all spectacle. It's about... you know, unless we think of politics as the presidential elections or whatever. But presumably our whole purpose is to, you know, not just remake the world around us, right, but remake ourselves, you know, in the process. And left-wing strategies require a much greater weight being placed on subjectivity and on the transformation of people. And like, yeah, you know, we might be able to see a rough approximation of the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell strategy in reverse, which I think is what a lot of people want to see in the kind of Bernie Sanders era of the Democratic Party. But I think that the result of that is probably something approximating the result of the new right's successes in reverse, which is like some policy changes, but essentially the world stays the same, which is that billionaires run everything, and the rank and file of the movement, their lives don't change at all. You know, ask the average working class evangelical, and Kevin, they're like your family members who you can relate to on a class basis. We actually don't want that as our we want so much more than that.
Yeah,
the goal of the Christian right was to purportedly reinforce traditional values and counteract the values of the sexual revolution and the hippie movement and whatnot, but went hand in hand with, you know, like as Kevin mentioned earlier, like the boss's offensive and the interests of capital. Mm-hmm. Now, guess what? We're not gonna have.
We're not gonna have a boss's offensive.
Yeah, we're not going to have bosses and the interests of capital to help us out with our, new socialist strategy. So, I mean, I wouldn't hold my fucking breath.
Wait a minute, Dad. Did you actually say freedom? Well, if you're dumb enough to vote, you're fucking dumb enough to believe them. Cause if this country is so goddamn free, then I can burn your fucking flag wherever I damn well please. And then I'm gonna stick it up your fucking ass! I can't.